And he's a, you know, a very interesting figure. I've read things about him, about some of the problems he had with people in the department, and I wonder how much you were aware.
Very much.
You were. Do you?
It was frightening at times. It was frightening at times because, in a way, I kept thinking he was, you know, they say genius is a hairline over to the other side. And it almost seemed that Carl had those, he did some really strange things all our lives. The strange thing is that I came to Madison not knowing anyone, boys or any students, as a student, a freshman. And my high school advisor was a man in Decatur, Illinois, who was an ag teacher. And I was, my name was Waltz, and I came at the end of the alphabet, so they put me in his class. It wasn't even a classroom, for a home room. And he taught us how to play football. He drew a thing on the wall, I remember that. His name was Walter Leichel. And the year I came up here to school, he came to take some courses up here in biochemistry. In the meantime, he had married our dean of women's daughter from my high school. So they came to live up here. And he was working in the laboratory, and my husband was a student then, with Carl Link and Conrad Elvium. And he said to Carl, "Can you come over to our house tonight?" He said, we're having a girl from my wife's hometown that I used to know in high school. He said, "We'd like to have a boy for her to meet." And my husband had had two dates with me. And he said, "Well, you came from Decatur, Illinois, didn't you?" And Walt said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, hands off, Carl, that's my girl." And I came that close to dating Carl Link. So we like to tell that because it was really funny. And Carl was a very everyday kind of person then. We thought he was very bright, of course, but he was not showing as many eccentricities. Then he went to Europe before we did. And when he came home, he was wearing capes and, you know, longer hair and much handsomer. But as we went over there, we followed him. We heard many places where he had made a stir that had not been just pleasant for people. So that was our first encounter with his being different at all. And then as time went on, there were many.
Do you remember?
Yes, many incidents. I don't know how much it's all locked up in the vault of biochemistry, I think, unless they've done something since. But there are many incidents when it was really frightening. He wanted, for instance, to put, you see, aspirin makes you bleed, as we all know now, because there's been much more about it. So he wanted to put vitamin K, which is a clotting, into aspirin, and Harry Steenbach would not have that. And they had these seminars, which I think you said Van Potter had told you about, or these, where they talked, and they had quite a discussion one morning about this. And Harry Steenbach said, "You would do more harm, because many people, like children, who would take aspirin, you know, would make more problems. Maybe they would be clotting too much." So there was all this discussion. He thought there was a better way to do it, you know. And they got into such a heated discussion that when they went out of the seminar, Harry was going into the men's room, and Carl grabbed him by the neck. And if some of the boys hadn't intervened, there would have been I think he knocked his glasses off. Well, there are any number of incidents like that I could recount, but that's the one that was the one I remember. He did that to Mark Stahman one day. So you never knew when this. And then when we had the Enzyme Institute, my husband was hoping so much to get the Enzyme Institute here. And he and Perry Wilson and Ed Gordon, I can't remember some, I could remember if I took time, the other men that were interested. This was right after the war. And there could have been an institute in Germany. Warburg had done some very exciting work in enzymes, the German chemist. But they invited them all to this institute here, which was a big thing. Elizabeth Waters was new. We all stayed, even we stayed at the, and the other professors from Wisconsin stayed there, and their wives and their children. And we had a wonderful time. And then they tried to get the Rockefeller people interested in money to start such a place. And when it was decided that we could have one here, and Rockefeller had gone along, I gave the dinner or the party of some sort in my own home. This is before we were in the president's house. And we had this Norwegian girl living with her, and she made very fancy Norwegian hors d'oeuvres. And it was all men, and that decided. And she always says she made the Norwegian stuff to put in those men that made them give the money. So every time she comes back to Madison, she has to see the Enzyme Institute. And she expected it to be, you know, as big as Liz Waters or something. She was so surprised it was such a little building, because it's a wonderful thing. And so we got the Enzyme Institute here. Well, when those important people from all over the world that were trying to sell on the enzyme thing came, Carl Link apparently wasn't a part of it. I don't know why. I guess his work didn't touch that. So he sat and ate his lunch out on the front steps of the biochemistry building as Connie was bringing these people in and out, in sort of red satin shorts. Now, men didn't wear shorts just around like they do today. And there were things like that all the time. When they had Professor Hart's farewell dinner, my husband was Toastmaster, and he asked Carl to do something. And Connie had just changed black-haired rabbits into white, and white-haired rabbits black. I mean, he found something that did this, which caused all kinds of commotion, because the beauty parlors heard about this, and they thought maybe there was going to be something wonderful. Well, it was just a little momentary thing in the literature. I mean, it wasn't any big deal, I guess, biochemistry-wise, but Carl made something of it, and he gave this eulogy to Professor Hart, but in order to kind of get around and do something snide, he had a black rabbit and a white rabbit he pulled out at the right moment to show how there had been this experiment. I mean, he was always doing that. It just seemed as if there were times when he wrote nasty letters from time to time. And I...
You mean two personal letters?
Yeah. And some of them I never saw, because they were just horrid, I guess. And then he went to the TB San. You know, he was in the TB San twice. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, it was like... Well, it seems to me it was over a year one time. And my husband had to keep him on the budget, of course. And that wasn't easy, you know, because budgets were hard to come by even then, or harder probably. But he never complained. He tried to do it right by Carl. And then when Carl was ready to leave, this just shows his eccentricities, he had been testing negative. His sputum had been testing negative for a long time. And every day they took it, and just a simple lab boy in the TB stand came in and took the sample and reported it. Well, one day, Carl thought he maybe wasn't doing it right, so he went down the hall himself and got some sputum from an old man that was dying and mixed it with his. And of course, the kid thought that couldn't be right, because it tested that. So he reported it negative, and Carl raised a terrible fuss. It was all in the newspapers with the TB saying their methods were lax, and he told all this story. Well, this is the kind of thing he did all the time. And when they were going to have their last baby, he had a notice on everybody's door that the Carl Links were producing, and I can't remember all that, but that is just typical, you know. It was a strange... He didn't come to my husband's funeral, and there was never any animosity, really, but Aunt Elizabeth came out here a long time after, so I hadn't missed him today, and said, "It's time you hear from the Links, Connie," and she brought me a plant. And that's the first time I had known. But this is the thing that he would do, you know, for no reason. And it was not only my husband, it was Harry. Oh, he couldn't stand Harry.
And no, I gather that.
Stallman, he just hated him. And there were other people. And our secretary, if you ever wanted to interview her.
Ontario.
Yeah. And has told me of a letter that Carl wrote that was so terrible about Connie, to Connie, I guess. And she said it was just before he died, and I intercepted it.
My goodness.
And she said, I just threw it in the wastebasket.
Did she say what it was about?
No. Mm-mm. I don't know whether she put it in the, she may have put it in the file, but Connie never saw it. And she said, "I don't want you to see it either," so I don't know what that was all about, because there was nothing. Their research didn't even touch each other.
There was something about calf scours. I don't know whether you knew about that.
Yes, I remember. But I can't remember that there was much controversy. But
well, he seemed to. The story was he. Link said that he had gotten a written permission from Connie and that Ward Ross was there at the time to do work off campus on this question.
Calf scours.
And then I gather that Connie denied that he had given him mm-hmm. written permission. And this was in a newspaper yeah. article I came across.
Well, this so could be.
Most of his blame was against E.B. Fred and Ira Baldwin for not recognizing his work and not letting him go ahead with it.
Mm-hmm. You just couldn't tell. He was so convincing because he was so bright that people believed him sometimes, and I think some of the things were not true. He may have, I don't remember that. I remember seeing calf scours in literature because I typed all of Connie's papers before they went to Ann, who did the final typing. Mm-hmm. But and we edited them some, and that he would ask me if it was something that I, as a layperson, would understand. And that's why I know as much, because he would explain it to me if I didn't. Mm. And then I'd say, well, why don't you say it that way in paper, you know? Because many of his speeches were to nutritionists or home ecs or, you know, a lot of things that weren't in the scientific journal. So I know more about those things, I guess, than maybe the average wife if she wasn't chemically trained. Because many of my friends would say, well, why did you want to know all that? Well, I don't know as I did in the beginning. Except, you see, I had 5 years without children, so I could do
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And I got into it. And it was a way of being together, and I soon learned that. I enjoyed that, so. But Carl was just an enigma to me. I just never could quite understand how he could do some of the really terrible things he did. He didn't like any administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Terry always thought it was jealousy of Connie because they were contemporaries. But he had no reason to be. Goodness, his things were patented and brought him in all kinds of money. And you see, they elect a chairman, as you know. I guess they still do that, don't they, in the department?
Yes.
And Connie was elected, and he was reelected every year. And that showed that the rest of the staff felt happy with him. And when he went up to be president of the university, I thought, well, I'm not worried about his handling anything up there. It can't be half as bad as handling Harry Steenbeck and Carl Link and all of their messes, you know. And there were some other prima donnas, too.
What other one?
Well, Frank Strong at one point, I think, not as a research man, but he had a lot of problems in his life with his wife, and we got involved in those somehow. And Ann would come to Connie, and one night she wanted him to go down to the police station with her because they'd found Frank's car someplace. And I suddenly said, you know, this isn't very sharp. I better go too. Because if he's going to want to get rid of her and name, he might name you as a correspondent or something because you were seen with him at that time of night. So if I didn't get up and get dressed and go.
Mm.
And that's crazy, but it turned out that he was at the play woman whom he married, Dorothy Hushman. And I always could kind of understand that, but Frank was a very mild, sweet person, really. I think he just had too much family. Anyhow, during that time, he was kind of hard, and we never knew when we were going to get called out the night by Ann. Oh, dear. So, but you see, now nobody would do that now. Do you think they'd call the chairman of the department and say, help me?
Well, apparently chairmen do get involved in,
I suppose,
in personal affairs. So they may not be calling in the middle of the night, but they often will talk to them.
Mm-hmm. We were talking once. Connie would make a decision about Carl, I think, and decide, well, he thought he knew what was right. He would just go ahead and not let it bother him. He never seemed to brood over things, never. And even the medical school, people said, oh, he's probably losing. He didn't lose sleep, no. He thought about it when he was there, and he thought about it from the moment he got up. But then, you know, he made a decision, and he thought he had to abide by it. And he thought that it was a good decision. I don't think he could have, he was a person who couldn't be changed, you know, if it was shown that it was not right, but so he didn't brood over the link thing either, but he just knew it was there always, and everybody in the lab did. And they were grateful when he really started working at home, because it took the burden off of these showmanship things. Oh, I just could be, I can't remember half of them. That he
did the students?
Well, they liked him. You know, he was colorful, like William Ellery Leonard was colorful, or any of the professors we had that were kind of far out. And I knew them all. I used to walk beside William Ellery Leonard. And Carl Russell Fish I had. All those men are colorful. It seems as if we don't have that kind now, and yet maybe we do, and I just don't know that. But and Kiekhofer was wonderful. We just loved him, all of us. And yet he was colorful too. His life was. We used to call him the Mexican hairless, because he didn't have any hair on his face. And strange things, you know.
There was I came across him yesterday in the presidential files, a piece of correspondence between Steenbock and Brittingham, which was very bitter. Steenbock was very bitter about something at Wharf. I don't know whether you know how much you know about the whole
Wharf
story.
Well, quite a bit about Wharf, because we used to have to go around sort of, see, every other university began to be envious, but at first they were critical of our having Wharf. And just as I was when they opened Hilldale, I said, no university should go into business, and look what that's done for the university. And my husband we had quite a few arguments about that. And he cut the ribbons for that, and I said, well, I hope in the first year I think it paid $1 million. Yeah, I just thought it was ridiculous for university to be dabbling in business things. Well, so do churches now, everything does. So we had lots of interesting arguments about things, and he used to lie. I would just keep thinking, and the first time when they got the $1 million check, I just thought, well, I have to call him up and tell him, because he will really laugh at that. That's the hard part of losing someone you're so close to, because there's so many things, you know, it's almost 21 years now, and I just still think I have to tell him that.
Yes.
And we did have such fun and lots of sparring. My husband loved to argue, and to take the other side of things, just to see really how you felt, you know. And then he'd sort of smile and come around, and you knew that he was just razzing you the whole time. He did that with students too, I think, and probably brought out the best or the worst in us, I don't know which, but it was never nasty arguing. I mean, it was for discussion. Now, what is that?
I think it's just the table.
Maybe so.
I could put this on the floor, and then it wouldn't happen.
But I think even the children found that true, that he liked to, and he loved good stories. So we had a lot of fun at the table always. That was the most fun, I think. And I think his students felt that.
Well, you were going to say something about Wharf. You went off onto the
Well, you see, all that came about. Actually, the first I remember, we lived in an apartment right after we were married on Adams and Oakland. It's still there, big red brick flat, kind of flat iron building. And it was new. When we came home from our honeymoon, we expected to go right in there. I had my piano and some furniture from my grandmother's, and we had to put it in storage, and Connie found a place for us to live over the Brennebaum Pharmacy there on Randall and University. And we lived there a month, and then we moved into our apartment. Well, one of the first things I remember about that apartment is that I heard a newspaper calling Extra, Extra, and since I was a journalist, you know, that was kind of exciting. Yes. And they used to get out extras quite often. And that was about my husband's work with iron and copper. And Professor Hart and Frank Strong, there were several of them. But I ran out and got the paper, and here the whole headlines were Professor Hart has suggested iron and copper are very important, and anemia and so forth. You have to have the presence of copper. And here he was, shown with this instrument that I knew he didn't know how to use. And by the time Connie got home, I was frothing at the bit, saying, you know, what is this? And he was so sweet to sit down and explain it to me that a major professor always gets, you know, pretty much the glory. It makes it authentic to have this man associate. And then his students, if the professor is the right kind, gradually begin, and he's down in the bottom of the list of, and of course that's exactly what happened. But I had to be told that right away. And about that time, then Wharf was formed, because we got, they had a patent, these men that did this iron and copper work, and it was very small, I think it was in Professor Hart's name, maybe they had their, the other fellow's names on it, but they were all young. And we got, Hart would get the money and divide it between the five of them, I believe. And that saved us more than once, because the Depression came, you see, right after we bought a house and a baby and a new car, first car. And we didn't know how we'd pay our taxes. But then that little bit of nesting, it would be like $200 maybe, I don't know if it was that much even. And that lasted for 17 years. So that must have been just about the time we were married. I don't know when Wharf was formed.
Actually, it was formed in 1924, but it was just growing very slowly.
See, and 26 that would have been we were married, so I'm remembering pretty close to the time.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, and of course, I was in school in 24.
Yes.
So that's probably just about. And when the Pellagra thing came along, I first said, "Will you patent this?" And Connie said, "No, because it's an." It's a natural substance. And he said, I'm glad I won't have to go through all that. And I won't feel ever apologetic for it. It's a chemical that already exists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and somebody said to me one day, well, why is that? Daisy Pop said that the other day. Why is that? Sunlight's a natural thing, too. And I said, yes, but the process of catching the sunlight. So there was that, and of course Harry Steen, it was Harry Steenbuck's idea, the whole Wharf thing. I think it's wonderful that he was far-seeing enough to see that. And it's been exciting to see him grow. He used to live with his parents, you know, to having all this money. And of course Evelyn was in the department.
Yes.
And as a biochemist herself. And
but he became very bitter towards Wharf. There was one point where Link, I think, asked that Steenbuck not be allowed to go to meetings anymore. And
he was not the easiest man to get along with either. I think after he was married, he seemed so happy that I really felt there was a change in the man. But my husband's first thought when Evelyn got her, that's what caused it, maybe, you know.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Because she says it was some kind of an accident, but I don't know. But they don't know what it is, I guess. Anyhow, that's water under the bridge. But their marriage was absolutely beautiful, and it was great. We were all happy. He would probably have married earlier, only his mother and dad just didn't want him to. And he lived at home, and we thought he was going to marry someone at the Kellogg Foundation, who was Dr. Mitchell, a beautiful older woman. And she was on some committees with my husband, used to go east with him, meet him in Chicago. And I just hoped that, you know, he'd tell me about this Dr. Mitchell, and I'd picture this young woman, you know, and I thought, maybe I should be jealous. I never was jealous, but she would write him or wire him and say, they both liked the detective stories. And he never read that kind of stuff at home, but she would read on her way from Detroit to Chicago, the first few pages, tear them apart and get a paperback. Yes. And so she'd say, I'll have so-and-so ready for you. Well, I just wondered about this, you know, and so he said one time, I went to a meeting with him, and he said, you must meet Dr. Mitchell. And here was this white-haired, lovely person, but, you know, Harry's age.
Yeah.
I could see. So he loved to kid me anyway. And he kept me guessing, I guess. That's why he was so much fun.
Do you, as you think back over it, in terms of how women talk about women's careers today, do you ever regret that you didn't do anything differently or have a job or go ahead with journalism?
Well, I guess one of the reasons I wanted you to see that resume of mine, if you call it that, was that I was always into things volunteer-wise. I there is hardly anything that I haven't had an office in Madison, I guess, and I don't like offices. I'm basically shy. I don't like to preside. But they always seem to happen to me, and often at a critical time when they would impress me that it was the moment that I had to accept it because they needed me. I love being on boards and working with people, but I never wanted to be in the top seat. And it hurts me when I look at it because I hear other women, they say, oh, well, she did everything, and she always wanted to be the top man, and I didn't have that in me, and my husband have to push me sometimes.
What do you mean it hurts you? You said...
Well, I just don't want to be considered somebody that's out seeking, you know, an office.
Oh, I see.
Seeking to be into everything. Because that was not the way I operated, but I just got interested in things. And first thing I know, I'd always seem to... Like the visiting nurses, for instance, and some of those jobs that were kind of out of my line, really. And yet I was on the first Madison League for Nursing and the first state league for nursing. Hmm. I never had any nursing. But
you mean somebody asked you to be on?
Well, the reason was because the dean of the School of Nursing here, my husband was then the graduate dean, asked me to be, I guess, on the Madison League for Nursing when they formed it. And they were very interested in reorganizing the... It's getting hot, and I'll tell you why in a minute.
All right.
They're reorganizing the School of Nursing, and she was very anxious to have Connie's ear. And I think that's why I was invited the first time. Well, then I became so... I went to national meetings in St. Louis and in New York, League for Nursing meetings, and did a lot of those things that just opened up a whole new field to me. And my
granddaughter...
Did you
give talks at these meetings? Did you?
Well, I did give a talk once on... I think that was in Milwaukee, the state meeting, at what the consumer expects of a nurse, of the nursing profession, when you're a patient. I hardly ever been a patient, except when I was birth baby, so I don't know why. Well, I was, too. I was in the university hospital 6 weeks when I was in school, like trained nurse. But I wonder myself that I didn't ever have this feeling, and I think I wanted to earn some money myself, to feel like I never earned money when I was in high school. I worked for the newspaper some.
Mm-hmm.
And my father didn't want me to do that. Then came the Depression, you know, and we thought women shouldn't work. And after my husband died, I really would like to have done something. And I should have, financially, I should have. But I had my dad. He was 80-something. He'd never been alone. Mother was always with him. And that presented somewhat of a problem. He was able. He could have stayed alone if I'd come in for mealtime. And I spoke to Leroy Luberg about it, and he said, Connie, I said, you know, I think there'd be something at the University of Public Relations or hostessing or something. And someone had spoken to me about the center building. Why wouldn't you be a good hostess down there? And I thought, that's a natural for me because I know all those people that come there pretty much. And Roy said, don't do it because everyone will think the university created a job for you, and that's all anybody needed to say to me. And so I really wasn't trained. You see, I had a year of college left. I could have easily picked that up. But I'd had a lot of experience, but it didn't add up to probably a job. And the closest I ever came to it was when I was on the Red Cross board. Our director dropped dead one day, and he was just shoveling snow, and so the board called me together with them and asked me to be the interim director, full pay. And I said, well, I don't think I should take pay for it. And they said, if you don't, you won't be here. Mm-hmm. We want you here all the time. Mm-hmm. So I went home and talked it over to Connie, and he said, that's a public function. I mean, the Red Cross is a public money. And he said, I don't want you to take that money. And so they said, well, then you have to take at least half time. So I did, but I was there full time when he got half time. I was so excited, I came home and bought a bedroom set with my big earnings.
Huh. And how long did you do that?
Oh, it must have been 2 months or more.
Hmm.
To
until they chose someone. And it was against national Red Cross policies. We didn't know it at the time, but there was something in the statute that says that a board member cannot be a director.
Oh.
But, you know, it turned out to be a very fortunate time, actually, because we have some people were drawing a lot of overtime pay, and I turned up something that had been going on for quite a while nobody knew about. So it wasn't such a bad idea. But that was fun. I really, and the family was simply great. The children, I think, were in high school or beginning college, and they all just rallied around to get me off to work every morning. So I can understand how families do help a mother. And but I guess I thought I had a full-time job with what I did.
And Connie thought you had. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think I thought so, too. I think with helping him as much as I felt I did. And he was always ready to acknowledge that I was a help, and publicly even, so not so much in just his president's job, but I mean his work. And as I told you the other day, I washed his hair he never washed his own hair. I mean, all these things that seem so real. I'm just saying, you really have more intuition than I have. But so he was just the greatest person.
We just missed out a little bit there. That you said that you should have been president.
Important.
Well, do you feel defensive now when you hear women talking about?
Yes, because I think volunteerism is very important, and I think you can learn so much from your associations with people. And I sit on the Methodist Hospital Foundation board now, with all the brass from all the banks and financial institutions practically downtown, and they're talking about things that are just way over my head, you know, and I wonder why I'm there. But I guess they've reelected me another two terms, I guess, another one. And yet I can ask questions sometimes that they haven't thought about, how this is going to look to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just inherited just a fabulous sum of money from this man, Henry Sage, who was Cap Times man, you know.
Mm.
And they're going to the Cap Times business meetings and all this kind of thing now. And I've been able to have some input there because I have a friend who was connected with the Lee Enterprises and had told me some of that. So we're looking ahead to what newspapers are going to be and whether we should sell the stock and whether we should keep it. And it's also, I just love it all. But I'm just a little nothing compared to these men. But they've told me things to help me in taxes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you say you're nothing compared to them.
Well, yeah, I feel that way. And I guess I am the only, there is another woman now who represents a retirement center, yes. She's a financier. She's always done that sort of thing.
Well, you think they have you on as a token woman?
And Mary Gray from the bank, as I know. Well, they've always tried to have the community represented on their boards, and they've had all kinds of faiths. The Catholic and every faith is represented. And you have to be approved by the bishop at their session. So I've been on the board, and I was on the committee that built a retirement center and those things. So I've come up through their nursing advisory committee.
So you feel you actually have contributed something to all that?
Oh, yes. But I just wonder why, you know, I'm chosen sometimes. I was ready to go off the board. I'd served all the terms I could, and I've been chairman of the nominating committee, and Bill Johnson said when I was retired from the board, he said, Connie is the one that's made our board strong because she knows so many people. And I was and no one has ever turned me down, like Mr. Warple at Wharf or they just are eager to be on this board because they think it's worthwhile.
Mm.
So now I've just been chairman of the nominating committee for the foundation. We got some good people. So I guess I have a function, but I'm always just, you know, what am I doing here? But I'm learning so much. And I think that must be more fun than just sticking at one job day after day, 9 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been happy, and I really worry about things like the United Way and these places where people spend hours and hours of their time free. And now, you know, it's so different when you ask a person to be on your board. He says, are you insured? Are our board members insured? And it's quite a different picture, so that you feel responsibility to a board. And I think the time will come when they'll pay for that. Mm. There are many hospitals are paying for their trustees. So maybe that'll bring people back into these works. But I would think it would be absolutely deadly to be a secretary.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily be that after all.
No, but you know, you might be. And they think that's greater than being a volunteer. So, you know, I can't, of course, I think we expect so much financially nowadays that there are two people working in most every family. My daughter feels she has to apologize. She was a career woman. She was Betty Crocker, and after she was married, and then when her children came, she decided she should stay home. So she and five girls, five former Betty Crockers, formed a company. They called Consumer Services, something or other. And they write recipe books and test and take, and they wrote one of the Weight Watchers cookbooks. And, but she said, it's not, you know, it's not really a full-time job. And she would like one now, but she's 52. And it isn't so easy to get one in today's world. Mm. So, but I worry about volunteer causes. I worry because they're not bodies to sit on the boards. And I worry because this new cutting all the human things in our country, the funding for them, it worries me now too. And plus not being allowed to get tax deduction for charitable gifts, all those things frighten me for what's ahead for volunteer things. And now we're having the same trouble with the league, University League now. The girls, see, it works, so many of them. And so they're not too attracted to just go to tea or to, you know, mm-hmm. And I can understand. I have trouble with that myself. But they've thought up this brown bag lunch at noon, and that's taken hold, and maybe we'll have some new gimmicks there that will. It's a changing world, and it's hard to fit into it wherever you are now, I think. I don't believe it's any harder for me as an older woman. I never thought I would get out of step, because I just love young people, and I didn't think he didn't like to reminisce. He was never liked to look back much. And he said, there's so much ahead, you know, and of course, I suppose that's the research plan, so I got that. My father was a great person to reminisce, but he had a lot to reminisce about. And he was so interesting to us because of it, but it bored my husband a little bit. Mm. And so I, early on, decided I can't talk that kind of thing to him. And we always said, you know, well, we'd always be with young people, we'd never get old. But now suddenly when I go to the bank and I don't know anyone in the bank, you know, the officers that run my trust, all of a sudden I get sort of frightened by it.
And all the paperwork, years old.
The paperwork, you know, that gets to everyone. And it must be awful to be a department head now in the university, because they have so much of that. My son is taking those grants up, and he says it's just, you know, he can hardly carry the boxes.
Yeah. You know, there's one last thing. I don't know that you have anything you want to, but just if you would say how you, this Women's Day, because that would be interesting to have that on tape.
I think we should have that someplace. Grace Chatterton had been going around to other universities, as I remember it, or at alumni meetings at other universities or something, where she had heard that they were thinking of doing something for women, letting them have an alumni day to themselves. And there were some women's alumni clubs. I think the North Shore of Chicago had one, and I believe Minneapolis had one. And so she had spoken to President Fred and to John Burgee about this several times, and they had not caught fire on the idea. And so she spoke to my husband, and he, being her contemporary, I guess, was more vulnerable and liked her. And So he said, well, why don't we have a talk around about this? And he asked me to have lunch, and Grace invited people. I remember this Mrs. Johns, who was on the Board of Visitors, and Ora Jones from Jefferson or someplace down there, and quite a few people from out of town. And Dean Troxell, who was definitely interested in women, was then the Dean of Women. And I think Martha Peterson was around then too. And maybe it was just the transition when Martha and Louise Troxell were changing. Or maybe Louise just came back for this. I can't remember, but Grace Chatterton would know that. Anyhow, it was a nice group of people, and my husband came for lunch, and as I remember it, some other men, I think maybe Leroy Luberg and I guess John Burgee, and they dreamed up this Women's Day on campus. And the idea was to sell to the state our blue, what we call blue ribbon professors. That was E.B. Fred's name for students who were super and so forth, and so we got to use it. And let people, many of them heard them on the radio, and they were fans. They just listened every time they spoke. And Petrovich was one, you know, you could just think of the ones that sort of caught fire, and let them see them. They're human beings, you know, you can talk to them, ask them questions. And this was just great. You'd be surprised, the people that came the first time, just to have the chance to sit there. Well, out of that, really, in a way, I think, came some of the continuing education things, because some of the women who came had the idea they wanted to go back to school, and this was a pushover. Here they could go. And from that, eventually, came E.B. Fred's, what do they call it?
The yes, women's the fellowship program.
Fellowship, yes. But I don't know if I should give this Women's Day all that credit, but I think the spark came from these women coming back to campus.
When was this?
Well, they had an anniversary last year, I think. It would have to be during Connie's presidency, maybe 59, 60.
No, it would have to be during E.B. Fred's, wouldn't it?
No. Mm-mm. It was afterwards, after Connie became president. The spark was planted with E.B. Fred and John Burgee before that.
Oh, I see.
Connie became president in 58, and I think it would be 59 when this came about, because it took about a year.
So the first actual
day. Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. What would that have been an anniversary of last year? 82. 20 years, I think, probably they'd said, but then maybe 25, because, well, that's easy to find out.
Yeah.
And so we started with just one in the spring. And then they wanted one, they thought they'd like to have one in the fall. So we thought we shouldn't do the same thing, and that we would have one for the arts in the fall, and then one for general things in the spring. And of course it was a beautiful time to come to campus. Everything is usually budded, and you know, and any alumni love to come back anytime, see Lake Mendota open. And Arlie Mux would usually have the crew out in front of the alumni house. So it just caught fire, and I think it got so big we wondered if we were going to be able to handle it. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Carol Morris. She was a very outstanding student on campus years ago. Her brother was Wayne Morris, you know.
Oh, I see.
And she was very active in women's work, student government, and so on. And she came through Mattis one day and called me and asked me if I could give her any kind of a lead, because she wanted to start it out wherever they are in Pennsylvania, I believe. So it's been copied many places, and it's a going thing. And a few years ago, they had to change the name to Day on Campus because they didn't want to eliminate the other gender. But really, it was started for women, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of bothered me, because I think we get a little too far on some of these things. I just noticed I got some material from the State Historical at Women's Auxiliary. They have to change the bylaws, change the gender now on that. You can't win. Yeah. But this day on campus has, I think, done a lot of good for the university. And one of the reasons we wanted it was to let people see that our good professors, but also to have it be our own campus thing. So we kept saying, we don't want to invite talent from the other campuses. Now, whether that'll always exist or not, you do kind of exhaust your talent sometimes, you think, but they like to hear them again.
Sure.
And if they're doing wonderful work, they can be repeated many times. And then I think the arts people have gotten interested. Then we have tours of the campus, you know. They go to the Yalvium, they go to the WHA, they go to the psychology lab, they go to see the multi-video stuff over. They've gone to the computer center, they do a lot of those things. And they've taken buses. And that's been cut down a little bit in the last few years because the mechanics of that are pretty difficult. And people, if they come from out of town, want to get home. So now they just have either ballet or opera or something in the afternoon. And it's over by 2:30 or so. But those women, some of them get up 5 o'clock in the morning to get here. And there's one woman who comes from Minneapolis every year.
Hmm.
So it's a big thing.
Do you want to say anything about the Yalvium?
The Yalvium, yes, that would be nice because it's such a wonderful place. Long before Connie became president, he went with Herb Kohler, Jim Watrous, and I, probably other men, but those are the ones I remember, to try and get money for an art center of some sort, or a place to have show art. We did have lots of nice art, and it was in the basement of Bascom. It wasn't very well taken care of. They tried to have air conditioning of sorts down there. And every time they'd go, I remember once they went to the Kresge Foundation, and they came back with some paintings, you know, or a work of art of some sort. It only made them another problem in a way, but no money. And there'd be great discouragement.
Why was Connie interested in this?
Well, I don't know how this happened. Maybe it was when he was graduate dean, I suppose. But he liked good art. It was really interesting. When he came to visit me the first time in my home, my mother had some rather nice things. She had a cousin who was a painter, and she had one or two nice things in the house. And she talked to Connie about art. I guess he asked her about these things, and he said, if my ship ever comes in, I'm going to have some nice art. Well, now this is a farm boy who had not been exposed to any of this.
Mm.
Hardly been out of the state of Wisconsin when I met him. And so, you know, this was hard to understand. But, you know, the Norwegian people have a good deal of art in their homes. And when we've had Norwegian students here, they often say that's one of the first things they miss in American homes. Well, now I think that's not true now. This would be 20 years ago when we had so many Norwegian students after the war. But so he had that in mind, and when we lived in England, we went many, many weekends, of course, to the National Gallery in London. And when we were in France, of course, we went to the Louvre. I mean, we always did that. It was part of our trip. And he especially liked a sculpture. So he kept saying, you know, sculpture doesn't have a place in a home, does it? And I said, well, I had an aunt who had pedestals with marble things, but I always thought it was like a cemetery in there. And so we talked that much about art. But the exciting thing was, before he died, one day, President Fred and Mrs. Fred were there, and we had a luncheon for the Brittingham. This was after Tom died. Tom Brittingham and Connie were very good friends. We used to be at parties at their house at the Brittingham. This is years ago. And I wanted to live in Brittingham House, but they didn't think there was money enough to fix it up then. So somehow or other, the family of the Brittinghams had decided to give this $1 million. And Connie accepted the check that noon at this luncheon we had, just an informal luncheon at the Union. And Mrs. Fred and Edwin, Connie and I are all crying because it was so exciting, you know. And that's really the beginning of the Art Center. Well, I never thought of that when he died. I mean, I didn't even think about anything being named after him. I was too distraught and more wrapped up in my own problems. I had to get a house to live in, a lot of things. And the men came out to see me from the foundation, Irv Meyer and Malcolm White from Milwaukee and Bob Rennebaum and two or three others. And they proposed this idea. they said they wanted to build a $3.5 million building, and they would like to name it after Connie. And I just said, well, I think that's wonderful, but I don't know, I just thought it would be a scientific, if there was anything, it would be something scientific. And they said, well, Connie, you can get government money for scientific buildings, and that's easy to come by, and see how things have changed today. And this is bigger than anything scientific. It's bigger than the university. It's bigger than the state. Well, I saw that right away. And I said, well, I hope I live to see it. I just, you know, $3.5 million sounded like, and I'd seen how hard it was to come by. And you know that they had it. He died in 62, and we moved in 70. And they had that money in hand. So it was a big, a really, a great thrill. And I kept thinking maybe Connie's name was the gimmick, you know, that it was the timing and everything was right. And the timing for the campus was right because we were just out of the riots. And they asked me to say something at the dedication. I said, no, I don't want to. But then it was so beautiful. And Bob turned to me and said, surely you want to say something. So I just stepped to the microphone and said that this is such a happy place. And I think anyone who ever comes in here will be happy. And that's the greatest gift we can have to this campus today. And you know, it was true. It was just, it's been like that ever since. And it, really, we've never had any of those bad things since. Of course, that's just a happen. So, but it seemed as if it was kind of a turning point, you know, for maybe we're looking at something else now instead of all the causes that we, I'm afraid again now, because there are too many things disturbing all of us. But, and I went back the next day by myself. And I stood looking at a case with some Oriental stuff in it. And there was a, I didn't know what it was, but there were some fine little pieces of ivory down here and something else over here. And I couldn't read the key over there. And there was a student standing beside me. She put her books down on the floor, and I said, can you read me what that is? And she told me it was a Pachisi set. And a very tiny one, you know. And she said, isn't this the most wonderful place? She said, I'm a freshman, for she didn't know who I was. And I came from someplace up north. And she said, I've never been in an art museum before, but this is worth coming to school for. And I tell you, and then there were kids in bare feet sitting on the floor with their books, you know, and one girl had a feather. She was going up showing this kid so that she didn't touch the painting. I just got so excited about that place, and I just knew that it was really going to be something. And before, well, I thought maybe it was a showplace for art for, you know, connoisseurs. But I think the students really use it, and that's just great.
Oh, it's a lovely place.
And then when I saw the classrooms, of course, that told me. And, you know, the funniest thing of all, I had this daughter-in-law whose name is Macbeth. Her aunt was Faye Macbeth, you know, that gave the humanities thing. She had something to do with the Milwaukee Journal, beginning of the Milwaukee Journal, her family. And if she didn't give a room, now Sally didn't know this, and we didn't ever dream there would be anything in the way of an elaborate inauguration or opening. And I didn't think about wearing formal clothes, and I was up north at the cottage, and I got word from Bob Rennebaum, it's long dress. And I'm the size I can't just go and buy something off the rack. So I had to wear an old one, which has always broken my heart. Of course, here I am on the front of the alumni magazine and all over the paper.
Anybody else knows it was all.
Well, really not that, except that I wore it with a little mink cape that I used to wear it with. And they made me take that off that night, and I never realized that, you know, that the armholes kind of showed my big fat arm and didn't quite fit me in. It was just one of those, it's a pretty dress, I still have it, but my daughter-in-law was one of this new generation, and she said, I will not wear a long dress, and I don't own anything like that. So she talked to my daughter, who could wear anything at that point, into buying a short one too, and Peggy came out, and all she could find was navy blue taffeta with black stockings or something, which she never liked. And Sally came out with a sort of a well, it's silvery looking jacket and coat and look better than any of us. And she said, well, I hope, and I have lipstick on for you tonight, Mother. She decided she wore lipstick in Europe too, and I sort of kidded her about it. And so we went like that, and when she walked in, she said, for heaven's sakes, and here's this room. The first thing we saw was the room that this Faye Macbeth had given in honor of somebody. So she said, I have a part in this place too.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Nice. Yeah.
So, and then after that, Faye, they gave this money to the humanities. And of course that thrilled Sally because she was a social worker, so that was great. But I feel the Elvium has filled a great need that we had in Madison. And of course, you see, one of the reasons they didn't get the Art Center at the university was there was this animosity from Madison. They wanted their Art Center, and they didn't want any competition. And I think they've proved there's room for two of them, certainly. And look at all the galleries now.
Yeah. Well, I'll turn this off, I think.
We've talked.
You wanted to say something about the Depression.
A year ago, I had a church meeting here when we were bringing our church. And a man came who was just going to talk to us about the David Crosby Orchestra having it perform in our church. And he came with a book and he said, Mrs. Elvium, I've never met you, but I want to ask you a question. I've just read a book that says all the faculty was cut. And their salaries were cut during the Depression for 10 years. And I can't believe this. And it says in this book they did it voluntarily. And I said, that's true. And he just couldn't believe it. So he sat down and talked to me a long time about it. And I didn't remember exactly that it was as voluntary as he seems to think. But it must have been at the faculty meeting. We were just kids, you know. We were just, and as I say, we just put ourselves in debt. We came back from England. Connie was assistant professor, and we thought we'd arrived, you know, so we could expend a little money. And the year in England was a total loss financially because it was just a grant and we didn't have any, and we did a lot over there. We wanted to see as much as we could. So the Depression was a calamity to all of us because we'd just gotten started. But you know, I can't remember that people complained very much. And I know people were struggling. And of course, that's when we started taking students because students came down and they didn't have any place to eat or sleep. And there weren't as many dormitories. And so we took students in, and what? They got their room and board, or most of the time they just got their room because they didn't want to eat with us. Mm-hmm. But I know one of our students lost his meal ticket. There was a restaurant at the corner of Park and University, about where Rennebaum's was, called the 1 Minute. And they gave coupon books. Well, now that's kind of not so unusual now because the union or the dormitories have had those. But anyway, you bought a certain price and you had that for a month or 6 weeks. He lost his, and he didn't tell us this. And he went out without food except what I gave him for breakfast for those 6 weeks. Mm. And we just felt terrible that we hadn't known that. And there were kids like that on campus, and faculty people too. And most of them had, as I say, student debts. So it was a very hard time for everyone. I remember that my brother-in-law, who was 15 years older than my husband, asked us if we had enough money for taxes several times. And we gritted our teeth and said yes, because we wouldn't take a cent. But, you know, we sometimes had pretty slim goings on the table. And yet, I don't remember it was a sacrifice much. You know, that the worst of it was we had thought those cuts would be replaced someday, but they never were. Yeah. And that, I think maybe that's what kept us going, that, well, when they came back, we were going to be rich, you know. But salaries, my son was surprised not too long ago. He was looking up something, and I think when he was in high school, his father was getting something like $4,200. And he never asked for a raise, but he was always raised because his work was such that they tried to keep him, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard, and it's hard not to say to people, well, we went through the Depression, but it really was something to go through. And we had tramps at our back door often when we lived in Nacoma. There was a railroad, mm-hmm. you know, the Illinois Central Railroad went very close to us. And I remember having to make the decision whether to feed them or not, because my mother found they were putting a mark on her house at home. So the next tramp could tell that was an easy spot. So, but everyone, I think there was no hardship feeling because everyone was in it together, and university people all had a job.
Yes, I think that was the crucial thing.
And we realized that
a little
we were fortunate.
Coming in.
But that isn't true today, always. You know, some departments have had to, I don't know whether that's true here, but I've heard of other schools where they've had to, where they haven't had tenure, you know.
Yes, I guess we're in Michigan, maybe there's been some.
I remember my husband saying when he became president, I'm still going to be professor of biochemistry because then I have tenure if they kick you out of the top job. You still have your place to hide. So those were difficult times, but they taught us a lot. But I think as a result, our children had too much. I don't mean my own children, but as a generation, because we just were so happy that we could give them these things, you know, an education. We never thought about their working for their education. And I think it's much better. My grandchildren have had to. And Lori, my granddaughter borrowed last year. I asked her the other day, she was paying her loan off. And I said, I don't want to talk about these people that don't pay their loans off if my own family's not doing it. She said, oh yes, I pay so much every month. And she's buying a car, so that's kind of hard. Paying her rent. But she's lived in a living room with one chair. And the
so
table.
She deserves it.
Yeah. So, but then